Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sean Wilentz, a professor of history at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. He is a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and his latest, Bob Dylan in America. He has an article in Monday's New York Times, Obama and the Debt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Wilentz.
Great to be here, Ian.
And in your article in the New York Times, let's start with the actual language of the 14th Amendment, because I think it's pretty stark and unambiguous. The 14th Amendment states that the validity of the public debt of the United States, authorized by law, is sacrosanct and shall not be questioned. So it's obviously that message is entirely missed on John Boehner and the House Republicans.
Well, yes, it is, Ian. I mean, the quotation read that actually from my piece. It's not quite, but you got it basically right.
Right.
It's clear, unambiguous. It was in the aftermath of the Civil War, really to protect the country from exactly what the Republicans are doing now, which is using the public debt for partisan purposes. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly lost on John Boehner. I wish everyone would point out, commentators like yourself, the President of the United States, Harry Reid, everyone, would point out that what the Republicans, or some Republicans, are proposing to do violates the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. I mean, saying that as clearly as that, clarifying the constitutional issues, I think, would make a big difference in this crisis.
Well, of course, the president had an opportunity at his press conference to say that. It was a long press conference. And in your article, Sean Wilentz, in the New York Times, Obama and the Debt, you point out that the president is influenced by legal scholar Lawrence Tribe, who taught President Obama at Harvard Law School, who 2 years ago insists that, quoting, the only political courage and compromise can avert a default disaster like the one that we're facing on October the 17th. Now,
right.
Let's face it, the word compromise is a dirty word in the Tea Party lexicon.
Well, I mean, there's not going to be any compromising with these people. I actually have another piece coming out later in the week in Rolling Stone magazine where I go through the whole history of what this Congress has done. And I think, in fact, that the president and the people around him actually misjudged this Congress when they tried to push for a post-partisan policy. In pushing for post-partisan politics, that was never in the cards as far as this Congress was concerned. This Congress has basically had to destroy him. And I think he figured that out the last time we went all through all of this in 2011. If you notice, his campaign in 2012 did not have all of that post-partisan stuff in it. It was a much more classically liberal campaign. But be that as it may, we're in a situation where, once again, we're in a standoff and we have to figure out some way to get through it.
I'm actually surprised, Sean Wilentz, about the role of Wall Street. The president clearly signaled to Wall Street to help him out with the Republicans and to give them a reality check.
Right.
And there's a lot of people on Wall Street that are extremely complacent and basically saying there's zero chance of this happening. And I don't take those assurances with any comfort, because I don't think you're necessarily dealing with economically literate people in the House, and I think you're dealing with people who are quite determined and quite zealous, and I'm not sure that they are bluffing.
Well, I mean, if you go on the conservative, let alone right-wing blogs, you'll find all sorts of people coming out and saying, no, this debt ceiling business is no problem, default's nowhere near, not going to cost us anything. Actually, the president spoke to this quite forcefully, I think, today in his press conference. I mean, that's just crazy. There are all sorts of claims that there's enough money there to pay off the bondholders, and therefore there will be no default. Well, the bondholders are part of the debt, sure, and they'll pay them off, but there will be plenty of other people that won't get paid. So, but quite apart from the economic consequences, it will be fundamentally a violation of the Constitution. And no matter what you think about the economics, and they're crazy about it, that issue, I think, is crystal clear.
Again, I'm speaking with Sean Walensa, Professor of History at Princeton University, where he has taught since 1979. He is a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and his latest, Bob Dylan in America. He has an article in Monday's New York Times, Obama and the Debt. So it's a bit of an irony, as you point out in your article, Sean Walensa, that the Republican Party back in 1868 in its party platform said about the debt is that, quoting, national honor requires the payment of the public indebtedness in the utmost good faith to all creditors at home and abroad, and pronouncing any repudiation of the debt as a national crime.
Right.
That's a hell of a good line. I wish Obama would use that.
Well, it would be useful. I mean, it was the Republican Party then was, we have to switch around the labels, the Republican Party then was the party of the Union coming out of the Civil War. But they believed quite clearly what the situation was, that there were Northern Democrats who were in a position to try and repudiate part of the debt by paying it back in depreciated paper money called the greenbacks. And the Republicans, seeing that, you know, seeing that it would be an attack on the government's credibility and therefore on the economy, that's why they put this section in the 14th Amendment. So it's the Republican Party then, the Republican Party now. Now the Democrats are the Republicans, in effect.
So do you think then that absent compromise and courage, as Lawrence Tribe has suggested, the only solutions to this situation, what about, as you point out, Abraham Lincoln, in a national crisis invokes emergency powers? Is that a possible route if indeed we go over the cliff?
Well, if we go over the cliff, I think that there's room for this. Now, there's a great deal of disagreement about what would happen, but you know, there are two ways of looking at it. First of all, the president has an independent responsibility to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. You know, that's his oath of office. If we go over the cliff, the Congress, the House of Representatives, but the Congress will have violated the Constitution of the United States. So, I mean, it seems on that basis that he would be duty-bound to do something, if only to uphold this oath of office and protect the Constitution of the United States, and then, you know, raise the debt limit, you know, summarily. There are those who say that, therefore, no one would buy those Treasury bonds. I'm not sure what to make of that argument yet. But aside from all of that, I mean, if, in fact, the market started melting down, you would be in an emergency. And, you know, much as, you know, Lincoln did with in the early phases of the American Civil War, you know, he would have to invoke emergency powers in order to prevent the general welfare from just being destroyed. There's also a question of whether he could then go back to the Congress. Lincoln went back to the Congress to get approval after he suspended habeas corpus. But, you know, that's another issue that has to be dealt with down the line. In the end, the president is not powerless in this situation, I believe. I think he has some powers to deal with it.
So as a historian, though, Sean Walensa, clearly in the nation's early years, the press was largely independent, shall we say, and quite vigorous, and they routinely slandered each other in ways that are fairly colorful. But do you recall, probably since Andrew Jackson, a president being treated with such disrespect? I mean, it's really affecting, and he brought it out in his press conference. In fact, he was asked about this, about not showing up for the APEC summit. And after all, this is the president who touted a pivot towards Asia, and he's not there. The Chinese are dominating the summit, and Putin is making snide remarks about, you know, this is no way to run a railroad. So obviously the anti-democratic leaders like Putin and the Chinese president are having fun at America's expense. But it seems to me that in their contempt, which is often irrational for this president, they don't understand that by extension they're hurting America, that yeah. You cannot separate the president from the presidency.
Well, that point can't be made too strongly, Ian. I mean, by raising this particular kind of crisis, too, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of political jockeying going on. But basically, they're holding a gun to his head and say, you know, as Lincoln said, you know, stand and deliver, give me your purse, or I'll shoot you, and you'll be the murderer. You'll be responsible for it. Going back to 2010, I mean, the vilification of the president in that midterm campaign was as great as I was as nasty as I've seen in modern times. I mean, they got pretty rough in the 19th century. You know, they called Andrew Jackson all sorts of terrible things. But things have changed since then, and what I saw in 2010 was just remarkable. And, you know, yes, I think you're right. There's a detestation of Obama that I haven't seen really since Bill Clinton, when they detested Bill Clinton so much. It may be that they detest any Democrat who's in the White House, that any Democrat is, in their mind, illegitimate. But it's part of why I just don't think that there's much room for compromise here.
But in Clinton's case, of course, they used, extreme extrajudicial means to try and remove him.
Yes.
Through an impeachment, which is, basically a trumped-up fishing expedition that didn't find anything until they found a stain on a dress. And,
right.
And obviously the guy was keeping a secret from his wife.
Right.
And
scandal.
Yeah, what's his name? Ken Starr became the sort of nation's pornographer in chief.
Exactly. Well, but you see, even with that stain on the dress, it was not an impeachable offense. It was an unconstitutional impeachment. And they went about doing it anyway without, a fig leaf, a constitutional fig leaf to that, so that the bar for impeachment has been lowered.
That's what will happen, though, Sean?
If
he invokes the 14th Amendment, won't they scream impeachment?
I probably will. But the question is how he does it. If he goes about doing it in a constitutional way, if he simply invokes the 14th Amendment and does it summarily before there's any default, I think it would be unwise, because I think the separation of powers, which, funnily enough, trying to stop an unconstitutional Congress by acting in that way, he in fact will be acting unconstitutionally, because the separation of powers is also clear that the president cannot interfere with the power of the purse in any way, shape, manner, or form. It's the Congress has that power. It's only in the case of an emergency, I think, that he can step in, which would happen if the Congress indeed went through with its violation of the Constitution and caused a financial meltdown. That's a very different situation.
So again, another question for an historian. How different is it now in terms of, one of the ironies that I find in the current situation, Sean Wilentz, is that a small group of very right-wing Tea Party people, and they're often called radicals, and I've gotten some mail from listeners saying, don't use the word radical, that's a noble term.
These
people are reactionaries. So being careful about how I label them, there's nevertheless a very small group, and yet they're holding the entire country hostage and arguably the world economy hostage.
Yes. Yes.
You have the so-called sensible center, where most Americans are supposed to be in the political lexicon. They're absolutely irrelevant now. Anybody that's talking about bipartisanship is living in a fool's paradise. And then you have the political left that's absent. So what's going on?
Oof, that's a big question, Ian. Let's take it one by one. In the case of what's going on the right or in the Republican Party, it's pretty clear that a failure of leadership, a decay in the leadership that's gone on really since Reagan left office, has left the Republican Party captive to this very, very vigorous and, I should add, well-funded minority. Without the funding of people like the Koch brothers and Jim DeBint and his Heritage Foundation, and others, Freedom Works, Dick Armey's operation, these guys would not be anywhere near as powerful as they are. What they have is the power to remove people, in a sense, impeach them in a funny way by elections, by running primaries against them. So that if anybody steps out of line, they're in danger of losing their seat. That's how they operate, and it's really quite vicious. And even within within the House conference, the House Republican caucus, Boehner is basically powerless. I mean, he said at first, announced publicly that he was not going to let Obamacare get in the way of a continuing resolution. Then he came out of the meeting and said, "Well, Obamacare is going to be part of the continuing resolution." And they asked him, "Well, what changed?" And he said something to the effect of, "Well, sometimes a leader has to listen." Leaders don't listen in that regard. Leaders lead. He was basically undone by these people, and he's been undone all the way through. So basically you have, yes, this minority has managed to finagle away with the help of all that money to basically hold the Republican Party captive and then hold the nation, as you say, and then the world. On the other side, the left, I mean, it's the Democrats are doing the best they can. And I know that there are divisions there about how to go about doing this. The White House has one strategy. The Senate has another strategy. The question is whether they're going to be able to stand up to this kind of blackmail and this kind of hostage-taking, which, you know, even as centrist, impeccably centrist writers such as Norman Ornstein and Thomas E. Mann, who did a book on the subject, have pointed out there's almost a pathology, an ideological outlier is how they describe the Republican Party today. The question is, what do you do with it? How do you deal with it? And I think that the idea of trying to compromise or trying to find some way to undermine them sneakily is not going to work. I think that in the end, there has to be a confrontation, and they have to be undone. Not unlike the way that Clinton undid Gingrich in 95, 96. He basically outfoxed him. There's lots of different ways to do it. But, you know, something has to be done to stand up to these guys, or else they're going to keep on going and going and going.
Well, it does seem, though, that there is something else going on here. And earlier in the program, I was speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders, who went to the oral arguments today at the Supreme Court in McCutcheon versus the FEC and spoke on the steps of the Supreme Court afterwards. And the point being that McCutcheon, if the Supreme Court rules the way they've ruled on Citizens United, right, is going to remove one of the last impediments to billionaires and millionaires and billionaires buying our politicians, which they seem to be doing wholesale in any case. And it seems to me that just these two brothers, the Koch brothers, right, and I guess if you add them with the Australian export, Rupert Murdoch, those three individuals have moved this country further to the right in the last few decades than I think could even anybody could have predicted. And the Koch brothers are doing it, and they're behind much of what's happening now. And the New York Times did a piece on it the other day saying, right, that essentially because they are using their money as a weapon, they're terrifying these guys on the Tea Party side that they will fund somebody even more to the right of the incumbent unless you step to their tune. And so that has the effect of moving the goalposts continually to the right, and that's
Right. That's the game. You know, it used to be that rich people bought congressmen. You know, back in the Gilded Age, and you bribed them or something. This is a somewhat different dynamic. This is terrorism. They're terrorizing the moderates and eliminating as many as they can and terrorizing the rest. And the terror is simply that, yes, they will be hit with a primary. Now, that said, there are still 15, 20 Republicans who are in Republican districts near where I am now, near Princeton, New Jersey, up in Philadelphia, down in Philadelphia. There are a number of Republican congressmen who have broken, have called for a clean, extension resolution. Because their districts, a Tea Party person will not do well there. It's a Republican district, but it's a moderate Republican district. There are still some of those. The problem is they don't, the question is how many of them are there? Is there enough there to combine with the Democrats to get something through? There probably is. But then, if Speaker Boehner goes that direction, he's got to worry about his own job because he'll most likely be overthrown by the Republican caucus.
So, well, but what's despicable about that? In order to keep his job, he's putting hundreds of thousands of Americans out of work.
Yeah, you be the judge of that. Yes.
That's a fact. Right. I mean, it's not
absolutely. I'm just saying yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, the other thing that I found extraordinary, by the way, just in terms of rampant hypocrisy, was when that mentally ill woman was shot on the Capitol and they did a lockdown, which is a routine they have where Capitol police grab all the congresspeople and send them into a safe room.
Right.
After that incident, once everybody came up for air and it was settled, the House then took to the floor and congratulated the Capitol Hill police on what they'd just done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without mentioning the fact that these same guys that saved them or protected them are being furloughed.
Yeah. Big government is a terrible thing until you need it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Sean Wilentz.
Ian, it was a real pleasure. See you again soon.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Sean Wilanser, Professor of History at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. He's a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and his latest is Bob Dylan in America. He has an article in Monday's New York Times, Obama and the Debt. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the role of the U.S. Catholic bishops in encouraging the House Republicans in their current reckless course.
Well, my funds are gone and the bank says no. I beg in the places where I